I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Our guest Saul Griffith says we can have it all if we adopt mass electrification from non-carbon sources. We can wean ourselves off fossil fuels, reduce our carbon footprint, address the threat of climate change, create millions of jobs, all while retaining our way of life with the same creature comforts and conveniences. He says it can be done because we have the renewable energy technology and know-how. Fossil fuels are not just a threat to the health of the planet, they are a wasteful source of energy. Electricity is more efficient and cheaper, which Griffith says makes everything else cheaper. Amid all the bad news and dire predictions about the climate change crisis, it's rare and frankly refreshing to hear someone who is actually hopeful and has a plan. Saul Griffith is an inventor, an engineer, a MacArthur Fellowship winner, founder of Rewiring America, and author of a book titled Electrify, an Optimist Playbook for Our Clean Energy Future. And Saul Griffith, joining us from California. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you very much for having me.
Nice to have you with us. I'm assuming as an inventor, you're an optimist by nature. Are you generally optimistic about everything, including the fact that we can address this climate change crisis?
I think most of my friends would call me an optimist, but I do... I did argue with the editor of the book about the title. I was not. Sometimes I think optimist means naive to people. So I think I'm hopefully optimistic, but not naive that it might be difficult to do what I suggest is possible in the book. But I do believe we can at least have hope that it is possible for us to address this climate crisis quickly and in a beneficial way.
And as I said in my summary, I mean, it's a big hopeful promise, I'll put it that way, that we can address this climate change crisis and retain our way of life if we go electric. And I wonder if we could sort of break down what we do now, and then we can get into how electricity can address this problem. We do, our fossil fuels contribute to something like our 75% of our contribution to the climate change crisis. Can you, flesh that out for us?
Well, today we use a huge amount of oil to make the gasoline for our cars. We use a huge amount of natural gas, both for generating electricity, but also for heating our homes and heating our hot water for our showers and heating our businesses. And unfortunately, we still use quite a lot of coal to also generate electricity. And in the US, 87% of our emissions come from those activities. The rest is a little bit from agriculture and a little bit from industry. And the question is, how do you, at this point, we just need to figure out how do we do all the things that we currently do with zero emissions? And in general, the answer to that question is electrify the machine at the user end and provide that electricity with renewables, whether it be wind, hydro, or solar.
Well, and you break down, and we should know by now just how wasteful it is to get, fossil fuels, to get it out of the ground, to put it through pipes or through, onto tankers and into more pipes into our homes, that the amount of waste is just extraordinary.
Yeah, I actually did a study with the Department of Energy where we traced all of the energy flows in the U.S. from where the fossil fuel is mined through where it's refined through where it's used. And we have quite extraordinary detail down to the nearly 1% of energy in the U.S., which is using natural gas to pump natural gas through the millions of miles of pipeline that we have. And 0.25% of U.S. energy is using diesel to pull the train that takes the coal from where it's mined to where it's burned. In fact, 7 to 8% of all the energy we use is just being used to find and mine and refine those fossil fuels. So if we electrify, not only do we eliminate the waste of the heating, the burning of all of those fossil fuels, we also eliminate the waste of finding and mining and refining them.
You talk about, Electrify is the title of your book, but it's also the work that you have been doing. As it stands now, how much of our energy do we get from electricity?
Electricity is about 20%, but we use a lot more energy so close to 35 or 40% of our energy goes into the energy sector. It's just that a little more than half of the energy we put into our coal plants and our natural gas plants actually goes up the smokestack as heat and is lost. So that's the other half of the equation as regards climate. If we do that with wind and solar, we don't actually generate and lose all of that waste heat. And that's why you can make the statement that if we electrified all of our end uses, so if we electrified our cars, we electrify our heat, and then we provide that with wind, solar, and hydroelectricity, you literally could run the American economy with the same size cars, same size homes, at less than half of the input energy at the front end.
And I'm sure you've heard this before, which is, you know, can we get enough power from wind, which is variable, you know, sun, which is also variable, from these renewables? Can we get a reliable source of energy to power our very, you know, energy or our power-centric economy?
We can. I always find it funny when people talk about renewables not being reliable. As far as I can remember, the sun has come up very reliably every day.
True that. Yes, it has. Right.
Billions of years. The question now is, do we have enough batteries in the system to store that solar energy for 24 hours, store that wind energy for a week at a time? And the answer to that is yes. With the electrification of our vehicles, that makes an enormous battery that helps with this problem. And curiously, if we electrify our water heat and our space heat, we can even use our buildings in effect as batteries. For example, by using yesterday's sunshine to heat your water and then that is kept in a storage tank overnight, that is in effect a battery. And all of those inherent batteries in the system will need to be employed if we're to realize this vision. And the cost of all of these batteries is falling precipitously. But it can be done.
So what happens is, let's say you have an electric vehicle, it becomes your vehicle and also becomes a battery itself?
Certainly once we have hundreds of millions of electric vehicles and they're sort of in abundance as opposed to a little bit scarce as it is today, nearly every household has multiple vehicles. And they will have sufficient battery in both of those vehicles. They'll find out they'll be able to use a small portion of the vehicle battery, for example, to help back up the house. But honestly, batteries are becoming cheap enough that you can also put them on the house itself and use that to help firm up the grid and firm up the solar electricity that's generated on increasingly on rooftops.
I mean, this sounds so simple. Why haven't we done it?
I think if we're fair to ourselves, fossil fuels have been good and reliable and cheap for a long time. And really, this recipe that I speak of is only just on the cusp of becoming economically the right thing to do.
Right.
I like to say to people, if you could have a country that had the rooftop solar cost in Australia, where electricity generated on your roof is 5 or 6 cents a kilowatt hour, if you could have California or Norwegian electric vehicle policies, and you had sort of Japanese or South Korean styles of heat pump heating, that's the recipe. The problem is that doesn't yet exist in one place. But if you could make that exist in one place and you watch the cost falling for batteries and solar, you can see that in about 2025, that fairly simple recipe would be saving the average American household, you know, a few thousand dollars a year.
I mean, the place that we live in is the United States of America. And as you say in the very beginning of your book, you don't want to take on people that say, oh, well, nothing will ever get past Congress, which might be true. I mean, you want to say, sort of put that to the side and say, let's look at what we can do, what the technology is about, and how we can harness this for our own good.
I think there's a lot of good reason to not, let's just say, not be optimistic about American politics. But I think we are, again, because the economics are just about to happen, you can be optimistic that the economics of it will drive uptake. In just to, again, use an example, in the US, only about 2% of homes have solar on their roof, because in the US it costs what they $3 a watt, or about 20 to 25 cents a kilowatt hour for that rooftop solar.
Right.
In Australia, where it's one third of the cost, and that's just because they have more scale and they've got good regulations that don't interfere with the installation, 30% of households now have solar on their rooftop. There have been days in the last month where the whole country was completely powered by renewables. And that's because solar went through this transition where it became cheaper than the grid. And once that happens, you know, everyone puts their politics aside when it's about their pocketbook.
Sure.
And so you see that uptake. And so that's going to happen here. And the price of solar hasn't stopped falling. It's going to fall by another 50% over the next decade just because of the sheer volume. And we also, you know, that's where the optimism lies, in the fact that the all of these things become the right market economic thing to do in, you know, basically ride that now.
Let me quote something from the Washington Post that speaks to what you just said. Tim Root wrote, the proportion of electricity the U.S. gets from solar and wind nearly quadrupled between 2011 and 2020. So from your perspective, and perhaps everyone's perspective, that's the route that we're on?
You know, it's funny. If you took the growth rate of all of these critical industries, let's call it wind, solar, batteries, they're all at 20 to 30% per year growing. And if we keep growing internationally, those industries at that rate, by about 2035, we would in fact supply the entire world economy with enough electricity to fully decarbonize. So that's how fast the industry is growing. Now, at the last couple of years there, because of exponentials, it may have to slow down. So I don't think that was exactly the schedule, but I think you can be optimistic that currently these critical industries are on track to grow fast enough to get the job done.
And so obviously we're almost up at a break here. So in a sense, looking into your crystal ball, the future is wind and solar, is renewables.
There will also be a little bit of nuclear power. So I'm not religious on any one technology, but you can tell that the cheapest energy is going to be the wind and the solar, and there will be a profusion of batteries. There'll be a little bit of nuclear, a little bit of biofuels, a little bit of hydroelectricity, I think it's hard to find someone in the energy industry that doesn't see that future coming. And really, the argument is now about how quickly it happens, as opposed to if it happens.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Saul Griffith, Griffith is our guest. He's an engineer. He's an inventor, and he's an author. His book is Electrify, an Optimist Playbook for Our Clean Energy Future. Much more after this short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. Let me just read this this news announcement. The Supreme Court just announced its ruling on two challenges to Texas Senate Bill 8. That's the law that bans abortions after 6 weeks and allows private citizens to enforce it with lawsuits. The court heard oral arguments on the case in November, and this morning, just a couple of moments ago, they ruled that the Texas abortion law could continue, but said that abortion providers had the right to challenge the law in federal court. Stay tuned today for NPR coverage of the ruling and its implications. And again, Saul Griffith is our guest today on Radio Times. He's an inventor, engineer, founder of the nonprofit Rewiring America, and says he has a solution to our climate crisis go electric. We're talking about his plan, his ideas, and his book, Electrify, an Optimist Playbook for Our Clean Energy Future. And as always on Radio Times, we want to hear from you. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, what you think of Saul Griffith's ideas. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Well, let's talk about electric vehicles, because clearly they are being fast-tracked, although there are some problems getting some of the, I guess, the metals that are needed for the technology for these vehicles. But nonetheless, it looks like they are part of our vehicle future. How do you see the role of electric vehicles playing in this idea that you have for an electric country?
It's really enormously enabling and impactful to do electric vehicles. We simply couldn't make enough biofuels to pretend that we could continue to use a liquid fuel for all of our vehicles. So electrification of them is really the only option. And, you know, the per mile cost of driving them now is already much, much lower than the per mile cost of driving with petrol or gasoline or diesel. You know, it's 3 or 4 cents a mile with electricity in those electric vehicles, and it's 10 to 20 cents a mile running your truck or car on gasoline. So really the remaining barrier is just the upfront cost.
Yep.
And, you know, not terribly conservative organizations like Bloomberg predict that 2024, 2025 is the year where these electric vehicles will have the same price in the showroom as their internal combustion engine counterparts. So that revolution really is underway. And it's quite extraordinary. And that's, you know, in Norway, you won't be able to buy a car that runs on gasoline in 2025. They anticipate 100% electric.
I was also reading someone writing about electrifying the roads. Is that part of your plan? Do you see that as an option?
Technically, that's hard, and I don't think it's necessary to achieve this solution. It is technically possible. I have friends who are working on, and it's a technology known as inductive charging. That some of you might know it because you charge your phone overnight on a little pad. So that is possible. But you know, with the improvements in batteries, with their falling cost, the increasing range of these vehicles, I think it's unlikely that we'll need that technology at any significant scale to make it all work.
And enough charging stations? I know that's part of the infrastructure bill.
You know, there's a few hundred thousand gas stations today, so we need at least that in charging stations. And yes, that is a piece of policy that went through in the infrastructure bill that is great. And we also, you know, there's going to be 220 million vehicles in our garages.
Wow.
And 280 million on our roads. So it may not need quite one charger per car, but it'll be close.
Here's a question from Paul. He says, we know the kind of energy it takes to run trains. Can it be done with renewables?
Trains in many countries are already powered by renewables where they're electric trains. And there's every reason to believe that we can run our train network electrically. There's precedent in a bunch of countries. There are some countries that are working on hydrogen for trains, but of course hydrogen, you know, green hydrogen starts with clean electricity anyway. So it is really also, you know, there's two different ways we can run trains on electricity, and both of them work.
Here's a comment from James. He says, I look forward to more solar and wind, but wonder if anyone is thinking about how to deal with the expected and unexpected downsides. For instance, battery waste and landfills is one that I can think of. What do you say to James?
I think that's a great question, and I think humans are bad at looking forward of the consequences of their actions. And one of the fabulous examples of that is our fossil fuels. You know, they were so convenient, so cheap that we were blindsided and resistant to believe they could also be ruining our atmosphere and our climate, but turned out to be true. On this issue, I think we need perspective. So the average American today, about 6 tons of carbon dioxide per year is sort of their pro rata share of the American economy. So think about that, 6 tons. It's many 10,000 pounds. If we just imagine that we give everyone, we do that electrically with everyone, and we do 50% of it with solar power, 50% of it with wind power, and because the sun doesn't shine all the time, wind doesn't blow all the time, we store 50% of that energy in batteries, then to sort of sustain that much batteries, that much wind power, that much solar, you'd need about 50 kilograms, and that's about 100 pounds each, of solar modules, wind turbines, and batteries. But because the materials that go into them, the steel, the aluminum, the silicon, the lithium, are valuable, they're actually reasonably easy to recycle. And so you can probably anticipate we'll recycle 80% or more of it.
Hmm.
And then instead of needing 6,000 kilograms per year, we'll only need about 50 kilograms per year for the same person. So that's a hundredfold reduction in these large movements of materials. So I'm actually, it's not that we couldn't mess it up by not recycling these things. We could, but I think you should be optimistic that this is a much smaller burden on the earth than the current extractive fossil fuel version, where that all of that material just ends up in the atmosphere.
There are critics, even on the green side, if I can put it that way, of things like wind turbines. They're worried about bird flight patterns, and some people complain, you know, that they're sort of visual pollution if they're sitting out, you know, across or not far from beaches. Again, what's your argument back to those people?
I mean, these things are true. People don't particularly like having a coal plant or pipelines in their backyards either.
Right, that is true.
And we will have to have some. I worked in wind energy for a long time and developed technology. Everyone fretted about the bird strike issue.
Right.
So birds hitting the turbines. But we've lost perspective. So in the US, the number one killer of birds is our buildings. And because birds fly into windows and in extraordinary quantities, billions of quantities. Second biggest killer of birds is our cars, from hitting cars. And the third and fourth are things like pesticides and poisons and then habitat destruction. And the fifth and sixth, I think one of them is cats. Household cats kill extraordinary quantities of birds. And so we forget about all of those and then target the bird problem on the wind turbines, which is, you know, 7th, 8th, or 9th on that list, and it's in the thousands as opposed to the billions. So I think we have to be realistic. We would like some birds in the civilization. We will need some. We will need a lot of wind power and a lot of solar power. So we will be seeing it in our landscapes. But that is necessary to get the job done, and we can't. You know, a worse option is continuing with our fossil fuels and ruining the climate, where, you know, many of those species have zero chance if the climate gets out of control.
You mentioned nuclear. Obviously, your focus is on renewables, on solar and on wind. But do you see a role for nuclear energy? And it is expensive, and it often takes, especially after Three Mile Island and, you know, some other near disasters, there's a lot of reluctance to build nuclear power plants.
I'm not anti-nuclear. I'm not terribly pro-nuclear. I'm sort of practically nuclear. in high population density countries, it's going to be difficult to put in enough solar and enough wind. And so nuclear has to be on the table as an option. If you look backwards, the safety record of nuclear measured in, you know, deaths per unit of electricity produced, it's enormously safer than coal because it doesn't cause the respiratory and the water table poisoning and the other environmental toxin problems that happen with coal. So you can actually, on the statistics, although the events you mentioned are scary, yeah, nuclear is really quite safe. But it's also expensive. This is true. So this is why I don't think it's going to happen in quite the quantities that some of the advocates think. It is expensive because actually a lot of the expense of nuclear is regulatory. So we could probably improve that and make it cheaper. But you, even if you do that, you then run into a limitation in terms of how much water you have to cool the nuclear power plant. So a lot of people will be surprised by this, but about 40% of America's water goes through an thermoelectric power plant to cool the system, and that's true whether it's a coal, a nuclear, or a natural gas plant. And that's really at the limit of the amount of water we really can run through at these systems. So even if we do nuclear, there's sort of this upper bound of cooling water for it, unless we find a new technology to do the cooling. And so it won't be 100%. You know, it might be 10 or 20% of our energy supply in the US. There are some countries like Australia who will do it with none. But it's certainly difficult to imagine China or Southeast Asia with very high population densities getting to zero emissions without employing quite a lot of nuclear.
Here's an email from Dale. While solar energy may work great in Philadelphia in the summer, in winter it would be a total bust. We usually get bright sunshine, a maximum of 2 days for every 10 days. I don't know about that, Dale, for sure, but he says no amount of batteries are going to work. Can you change his mind, Saul Griffith?
Well, if he's in Philadelphia, he'll probably be connected to an international, you know, a national grid that also has nuclear resources on it, a lot of wind resources on it, and solar that's being imported across state lines. So I agree with Dale that if you're trying to solve it in the city of Philadelphia using only solar in the city of Philadelphia, it's unlikely to work out. But if you see that, you know, in the real world, we already move electricity enormous distances from hydroelectric facilities in the north of the country here. We move electricity from east to west enormously, and that will be more true in this future world. And it's actually, you know, so the sunrise in Maine might or in Florida might power the morning in Philadelphia, and the sunset in California might be powering Philadelphia in the evenings. And offshore wind power, which is very predictable and a good resource along the East Coast. And all of these things will be interconnected. And there will, like I said, be a little bit of nuclear that helps even it out. So I think it is possible, but we have to play together and think big.
And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Did you just say we have to play together and think big? I like that.
Yes. It would be nice for humans to sit up and to solve this crisis, we need a little more collaboration than we're currently seeing. But it's not without historical precedent.
No, it's not. And in fact, you write about that. And it's clear you're not a native-born American. You're Australian, I believe. But you do write about America's ability in the past to take on big projects. I mean, whether it was, you know, World War II or some of the other world wars, the race to the moon, even dealing with hydrofluorocarbons, that we have done big things in the past. But I think there's a feeling, you may not feel it, that we're so at loggerheads that it's hard to imagine us solving big problems right now. We can't get the country to be fully vaccinated so that we can fight off this COVID.
I think this is where one's optimism is tested. But, I moved to America in 1998 to go to MIT for school. So I've been here for more than half of my life now. Right. I think the country has become more divided in the time since I've been here, but certainly why America was an attractive place for me to come as an immigrant and for many other immigrants is because of its history of doing quite extraordinary things and being an exciting place on the cutting edge of technology. I think there is reason to believe we might struggle here, but America is a country that really responds to the economics of something, and the future in terms of all these technologies is just around the corner. This book wasn't written to look retroactively. Right. It's looking, you can now forecast out in the middle of this decade where handily all of these technologies are cheaper than the fossil fuel incumbents, and it's just going to be the right economic decision. And I think some of our partisanship over these issues will go away once the economics are in favor.
I hear you. Here's a comment from Adrian. Please ask your guests where the minerals and the copper especially is going to come from for this massive build out, and what is the environmental impact of mining?
Well, like I said before, we're mining, the thing that we mine in the greatest quantity today is fossil fuels, and the second thing we mine in greatest quantity after that is the things we use to make concrete. So comparatively, the metals, it is largely metals that we're going to need for this transition, will have to come from somewhere, but they will be in lower quantities than the fossil fuels. Copper in particular, we will need a lot of, and it has a history of not being terribly good environmentally. And, you know, my native country, Australia, has done quite a lot of damage in Papua New Guinea through poor copper mining practices. But there really isn't quite an extraordinary amount of copper in the world, so it can be, it's not, we won't be short of it, but we will have to improve the mining practices. And make sure that most of that copper is recycled at end of life. But no one, you know, apart from potentially some shortage on cobalt, which is an alloy in some of our lithium batteries, there's no material that people forecast will be short of anymore. And even that cobalt will be, the solution there will be, we will change the chemistry of the batteries over the next few decades, and increasingly there'll be less of that. So I think there is, the world will continue to not be perfect, but it will be more perfect than the extraordinary damage we do finding and mining and refining fossil fuels today.
Well, let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Again, Saul Griffith is our guest. He's got a new book, which we are talking about. It's called Electrify, An Optimist Playbook for Our Clean Energy Future. And we're talking about his ideas, his plans for how to electrify most of our economy, of our country, the benefits, obviously the challenges as well. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Do stay with us. Much more.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking about why we should electrify most everything. Our guest, Saul Griffith, is an engineer. He's an inventor, believes that electrification powered by renewables can save the planet, can save money without sacrificing our way of life. And he lays out his ideas in his new book, Electrify, An Optimist Playbook for Our Clean Energy Future. And he was a recipient of a MacArthur Fellowship, the so-called Genius Award in 2007. And again, we always want to hear from you on Radio Times. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You take issue, taking issue might be too strong a word, but you push back a little bit on this idea that I guess came from the 1970s, which I remember very well. We were told to turn down our thermostats. We had Jimmy Carter in the White House, you know, putting on his sweater. He did put solar panels on the White House, which I do applaud. But nonetheless, you're saying this sort of this idea of having to do less is just not going to play with Americans, and maybe a play with people across the world. Flesh that out for us.
The history of the environmentalist movement is really interesting. So 1970, we had the first Earth Day and the first massive global acknowledgement that we had environmental problems. That was quickly followed by the 73 oil crisis, which was a supply crisis that landed on Richard Nixon's desk. This is where 15% of America's energy flow was cut off by virtue of the Arab oil embargo.
Right.
It was an enormous crisis. There were lines around the block for gasoline. People were sitting outside in their cars at night with handguns, trying to make sure that no one stole their precious gasoline. The response to that was instant, and they scrambled. We didn't have a Department of Energy at that time. Nixon set in the process that created the Department of Energy, the Energy Information Agency, so that we would have the institutions that would protect us from these future problems and solve this one. And the solution that sort of evolved out of that, how it became policy, was efficiency. The idea was if every car was 15% more efficient, if every furnace was 15% more efficient, you'd solve that problem of that missing 15% of oil. That became policy quite literally in CAFE fuel standards, which was the corporate average fuel economy standard that automakers had to hit. And it became policy with these Energy Star ratings, which were efficiency ratings for the appliances in our homes.
And would you say, at least under those circumstances, it had some impact?
It had some impact. It didn't drastically reduce it. America has consistently used more and more energy, but it has sort of kept in check that growth. So it has been useful, and we can continue to make natural gas heaters 1 or 2% more efficient. But most of these things are getting close to the limits of efficiency, and there's this curious thing about electrification that if you electrify the end use machine, the car, and you'd use solar or wind energy to charge that vehicle, that vehicle will be more than 3 times as efficient in energy use as a gasoline car. So actually, turns out the efficiency we've always been looking for might be this thing called electrification. If you use an electric heat pump to heat your home, in most climates in America, that will use 1/3 or less of the energy that natural gas would if it was heating your home or heating your hot water. Same as even with cooking. Electric induction cooking uses about half the energy of cooking with natural gas and is faster and cleaner as well. So if we provide all of those end-use machines with clean electricity, that's the efficiency win we've always wanted. So the reason to emphasize that is that by going to electrification, we make the machines themselves so efficient that we don't have to use the other sort of 1970s efficiency prescription, which was change your behavior, catch more public transport, live in a smaller house, turn the thermostat down. While they also help, it is technically feasible just by going through electrification to have all of the modern conveniences.
You're a big fan of heat pumps.
I am a big fan of heat pumps. Some of my friends use heat pump as my middle name.
Truly?
Yes.
Because you can what, swap out your furnace for a heat pump?
Really, it's the only option for us to do all of our heating. So heating our buildings is a large source of our carbon emissions, more than 10%. And the only real option to keep that heating going is to do it with electrification. You could just use traditional resistive heating, like old baseboard heating, but actually heat pumps per unit of electricity give you 2, 3, or even 4 times as much heat. So they really are kind of this magical wonder machine that can give us a pathway to the future. And, already every American has 1 or 2 heat pumps in their homes. They just may not know it. Every refrigerator is, in fact, just a heat pump. And every air conditioner is a heat pump. In fact, some air conditioners now, not only can they cool you in the summer, but you can, what they call, it's a reverse cycle air conditioner. You can run it backwards and it provides heat in the winter. So I'm a fan. In fact, every American is already a fan of heat pumps, but we're going to use it for more than refrigeration. We'll be using it for heating your water and heating your home as well.
Yeah, we just didn't know it until now. Here's an email from Ronald. Here's an idea, he says, I have had for decades. Run a car on solar panels on the roof hood and trunk lid, turbines next to the headlights, batteries behind the rear seat, water tank instead of gasoline, hydrolysis powered by the stored energy, and fuel cell to power the car, refills of water due to evaporation and or leakage. The rest of the engineering can be figured out by the experts. I think you're one of those experts, Saul Griffith. Does he have something?
I think all of those ideas are good. I'm not sure that I would put all of them into one vehicle.
It seems like kind of a wildebeest, right?
It is. I actually think we still need creativity and invention. So I applaud everyone who's thinking creatively about trying to fix climate. But just to use some of those ideas as an opportunity to talk about some of the misnomers. So there is this idea that we would use electricity to create hydrogen, to put hydrogen in the cars, to run a fuel cell to run the car.
Yeah.
In fact, I worked with the Department of Energy and developed hydrogen tanks and sold that technology to a whole group of the world's automakers. So I think some small amount of the future vehicles will drive on hydrogen. But here's the unrecognized fact with hydrogen. If I generate solar electricity and I put it in a battery and then run an electric car, I'm using 85% or more of that solar energy. If I use solar energy to make hydrogen, just because of the laws of physics, we lose about 30% of that solar energy in the electrolysis. When I compress that hydrogen so that it can be conveniently stored in a car in a tank, I lose another 10% of the energy in that hydrogen. And then when I use a fuel cell, I'm only going to get out 60 or 70% of the remaining energy. So I lose another 30 or 40%. Hmm. And so really, in terms of solar energy into moving the car's wheels, just going purely electricity to battery is two or three times better than it's going to be with hydrogen. And then to one of the earlier comments, you know, we're going to need an awful lot of wind turbines and an awful lot of solar. We don't need to double or triple that by converting into hydrogen.
What about costs? And I mean, you do tackle this in your book. And if a family, let's say, is going to buy solar panels for their roof, or they're going to get heat pumps, or they're going to, you know, have more energy efficient appliances, that's going to add up. How do we address that?
So, through the organization I founded here in the US, Rewiring America, and through a similar organization that we founded in Australia called Rewiring Australia, we've actually looked at household economics. Just to give a little bit of background so people can believe this story, we know that every time you double the amount of wind production, that it's lowering its cost by about 20%. That's called the learning rate. Every time we double the amount of solar we produce, the price drops by a similar 21, 22%, and batteries are dropping also by about 20% every time we double the amount we make. So curiously, just by committing to the scale of addressing climate change, we're going to need so many of these things that we're going to double two, three, or four times that production rate. So the cost of these things are going to fall by more than half just by getting to the scale where America is mostly electrified and the whole world is on this pathway.
Right.
That's what's driving the underlying cost reductions. So if you take those cost reductions and you take the data of how an average American household uses energy today, and we know how much it costs. Average American household spends $62,000 a year on everything in the household, and they spend about $4,500 of that on fossil fuels. Whether that's because they're buying electricity that's generated coal, whether that's the natural gas that comes into the house, or whether that's the gasoline and diesel for their vehicles. If you take those behaviors and you substitute in the electric car, you put solar on the roof, you put a battery on the side of their house, you put heat pumps in the basement for the water heat and the space heat, you will reduce the amount of energy used by that house by more than half. You'll increase the amount of electricity a couple of times, but you'll actually find that you'll save that household about $2,500 or $3,000 a year. Now, that wouldn't be true if you went out today, because we're still early, but that's going to be true in about 2023, 2024, 2025. So that future of big household savings is coming. In Australia, it's actually happening a little bit sooner. And the reason for that is Australia has had what's called a rooftop solar miracle. You can install solar in Australia for $1 a watt. It's one-third the price that it costs in the US. And that is the electricity generated on rooftop in Australia is cheaper than anyone can purchase electricity in the US. Yeah. This is why we can know this is coming, because it's already happening in a country that, you know, largely looks a lot like the US. And in fact, if you look at the economics for a household in Australia, they're going to save about $5,000 a year by the middle of this, or towards the end of this decade. So that's just an extraordinary, there's an extraordinary win coming for everyday people once we commit the country to this pathway.
And you are listening to Saul Griffith. We are talking about his plan for electrifying America, and his book is called Electrify, an optimist playbook for our clean energy future. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Are we going to see, I mean, under your vision for the future, are we going to see just a lot more wires than we see now?
I think that's a good question. So, you know, when you research a book like this, and I guess it's just my nature, you remember some extraordinary things. There's about 185 million utility poles in the U.S. that are carrying all the wires that come directly to our home. Curiously, most of those are in the distribution grid. That means the local grid that's getting the electricity from the substation in your city to your home address. We don't need an extraordinary many more of those. In fact, the way we've designed the system since the 1900s, really, is with excess capacity in mind. So, you know, every household has a 100-amp, what they call a load center or a fuse box. You might know it as that gray box in the garage or the basement. Mm-hmm. That's where the electricity comes in your house. 100 amps at 120 volts is about 10 kilowatts of electricity that it could be delivered to that household. Even if you electrify everything in that household and it's got two cars and it's got a hot tub and you electrify all the other things, that house will likely only use 3 or 4 kilowatts on average. So it's quite below the rated capacity of that system. And so we did that for safety factors and for a whole host of reasons, partly that you write the codes, the national electrical codes, based on you assume that every single thing is turned on in the house at the same time, and that's why it's 100 amps. Why, in fact, you can blow a circuit, because you could turn on one too many light bulbs or plug in one too many cars, the circuit trips. But we've got to remember that since the 1900s, what we've invented was this thing called computers, which means all of these things can be controlled and can be smart. And now with a smart load center, and there's a California startup called Span making one, and there's established companies like Schneider Electric that make one, those smart load centers are going to be able to manage all of this load. And so actually, it's under, you know, because there's overcapacity, we don't need a huge amount more wires in our local distribution system. We will need more wires crossing the country north to south and east to west for the transmission of this electricity, but not as many as we might expect.
You know what, Saul Griffith, we have to leave it there. Thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And again, the book is called Electrify. He's an inventor and an engineer. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. And the show is produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscowane, and we do want to close things out with a little piece of music we could not resist. This is Marcia Griffiths, Electric Boogie, more affectionately known as the Electric Slide.
Teach you, teach you, teach you.